Hello, hi, let's get started. So welcome to the filmmakers panel, and the panel's title is Documentaries as and about Queer Documentation. My name is Hongwei Bao, I'm from University of Nottingham from UK. I'm not a documentary filmmaker, I'm a queer media studies scholar and queer historian on China's queer cultures and activism, but I work with filmmakers a lot, primarily actually. I write about their films, critique their films, and sometimes translate subtitles and do English translations for free. So it is my great privilege to work with three filmmakers on this panel. So the first person on my right is Ingrid. Ingrid Rieberg is a senior lecturer in the Department of Cultural Sciences, University of Gothenburg, and she is the director of the short film Feng Fuck, I like this name, and several other projects, interactive performance installations. She's also the co-editor of the new book, The Power of Vulnerability, Mobilizing Affect in Feminist, Queer, and Anti-Racist Media Cultures. By the way, I've checked the book online, which looks fascinating. So I encourage everybody of you, actually, either to order a book or order a book for your library. That's a better option.
It's open access.
Okay, fantastic. That's even better. Okay, great. So that's Ingrid, and she's the first speaker. And after Ingrid, we'll have, by the order of the list, Paul Detweiler, which is sitting on far right, but you're not a far right person. I left, sorry. Sure. Yeah, that far left person, actually, is a filmmaker and a science educator whose recent film, San Diego's Gay Bar History, which is going to be shown tomorrow, actually, during the lunch martini. So make sure that you go and see that film tomorrow. But Paul is going to talk about the process of researching and making this film today. And he also made another film called 22 Hitchhikers, which was inspired by photographs discovered in the One Archives collection and has screened internationally at 22 LGBT film festivals. And that film is going to be shown tonight, actually, in tonight's documentary film night. So please come. The last speaker is sitting next to me, which is Deepak. Deepak Srinivasan is a Bangalore-based performer, theater maker, art educator, designer, and community media practitioner with 40 years' experience. He was part of the MARA, a community media collective, and co-led urban public arts projects, which led to multiple performative interventions in the public sphere, supporting women and LGBT rights. So the three filmmakers are going to present their projects first. Each one hopefully take about 20 minutes. And at the end of our presentations, we're going to have a discussion afterwards. And we have to finish this panel on time because at 5:30-ish, there will be a performance in this exact space. So I'll make sure that this session finishes on time. So here to you, Ingrid.
Thank you very much. I think there's a mic here.
Okay, sure.
All right. Is the sound okay here? Yeah? All right. So I'm really, really thrilled to be part of this filmmakers panel and really look forward to the discussion also with the audience after this session. So I will speak both as a film scholar and as the filmmaker of the documentary An Army of Elskande, An Army of Lovers, a film that is also included in tonight's documentary film my program at 7, so warmly welcome. I hope some of you will make that. And so since you have not seen this film yet, I will give a small introduction and background to the project, so which is has been both an artistic and an academic project. And I will also, in this presentation, focus on some issues of queer archival moving images and on the process of researching researching and including audiovisual material from queer history in my project. So I will show you the trailer, actually, to the film, so you will get a small idea of what it is about. It's with English subtitles.
Hur känner man att man är homosexuell? Är det att man inte har dragit till det andra könet? Eller hur upptäcker man det?
Ja.
Hur känner man när man går ut med en kille till exempel?
Ja, men just att man inte är helt lycklig.
Till och med under vår förlovningstid så sa jag till min fästman, jag tror inte det här kommer att gå därför att jag vill vara med kvinnor. Och då sa han lugnande, nej men det går nog bra, det ska nog gå över, ska vi se.
Slår man upp i uppslagsböcker var vi sinnessjuka och galna, och några rollmodeller fanns inte i min lilla stad där jag föddes. Det var en ful gubbe nere i slussarna.
Ibland var jag ju ledsen, för det fanns inte så många exempel på det livet som möjligtvis skulle bli mitt.
När bilder av män visas får patienten en elektrisk stöt.
Det går inte att bota homosexuella. Man är för sådan, det går inte att bota.
Homosexuella män och lesbiska kvinnor demonstrerade för att bli accepterade i vårt samhälle.
Jag ville ju vara med och berätta en annan historia. En historia som jag själv hade upplevt.
Så vi tyckte då att varför inte göra en film om oss?
Kulturchefen, han tyckte det här var det jävligaste han hade sett. Och då hade han säkert sett avrättningar och lik.
Filmen väcker, tror jag, både oro, avsky, äckel.
Jag tror att vi var för tidiga med att inte be om ursäkt. Men vi bars alla av den här känslan av att vi hade någonting att berätta.
Jag känner en väldig stolthet att jag har varit med och ristat lite i kampen, så att säga.
Det är ingen annan som kan definiera dig, det är du själv.
Okay, so this is a feature length documentary, and it had its international festival premiere at Stockholm International Film Festival in November 2018, last year, and its national theatrical release also very shortly after that, so in December 2018, and it has also been broadcast on the Swedish public service television during the spring, and it's currently available in Sweden online at the Swedish television player. And this spring it has also begun traveling outside of Sweden, so it screened at a few international queer film festivals in Europe. And I was very honored 2 weeks ago to hear that it was selected best documentary at the Mostra Fire Queer Film Festival in Barcelona. And yeah, sorry. I hope we will continue to travel more, and tonight is the first German screening. In the fall it will be at the Hamburg Queer Film Festival. So the documentary is about queer filmmaking and self-presentation as a crucial part of the liberation movement in Sweden in the 70s, and it tells the story of three films that were all made or went into production in 1977, which is also the year when the first liberation march happened in Stockholm. And these three films were The Woman in Your Life is You, Kvinnan i ditt liv är du, a short documentary campaign film about lesbianism and the organization Lesbian Front in Stockholm, Eva and Maria, a short fiction about two young women falling in love and dealing with both positive and negative reactions from their family and friends. And then the third is Bög Jävlar, Damned Queers. That was how it was translated back then, which is a short documentary about a gay male collective living together in Stockholm. So these were the first publicly funded, supported Swedish films by and with open gays and lesbians. And so by accounting for these three unique films, their production and reception histories, my documentary is also a kind of reflection of the liberation era in Sweden before AIDS. And the film, my documentary, combines archival material from these three films, but also from other sources, with newly shot documentary scenes and interviews with the film activists of the 70s. And this new material was largely shot on analog film, so using 16mm and Super 8, which you maybe noticed in the trailer. These three films can all be described as rather typical products of the time, both in content and style. They all fit into the transnational category of films made during the liberation era that Richard Dyer has called affirmation films. So that is films that are characterized by the key aim to represent homosexuality as a positive thing to be. So they're informed by the practices of gay and lesbian organizing of the time, such as coming out, consciousness raising, activism, and the creation of positive images. And this is an aim, this aim to promote queer life in a positive way runs through all these three films. But just as important, another characteristic aspect of them is that they also include performative and theatrical, campy, humorous elements. So through drag and parody, there is fierce criticism of traditional gender roles and of dominant stigmatizing notions of homosexuality as a deviance. And in my work on these films, I find it important to emphasize these aspects because these films belong to a category of cultural production that could and also has been dismissed as naively essentialist or as politically and aesthetically unsophisticated sort of before the more critical queer perspectives of the later decades. But in this regard, I mean, Richard Dyer, Thomas Vaughan, and also Greg Eumanns and others have all done important work in theorizing and contextualizing the complexities of filmmaking in the liberation era beyond these notions of essentialism and the politics of coming out. So for instance, Newman's work on the pivotal documentary Word Is Out and also on the late Barbara Hammer's work is has been really important also to me in my work. So part of my approach to these Swedish films, both in my academic writing and in the documentary, has been to kind of like reassess these films from the 70s. In Sweden, they've been more or less completely forgotten and overlooked in, I mean, both in film and queer historical accounts. If they have been talked about at all, it's been with like a slight embarrassment almost. But now, so since I started this project many years ago, now it's two of them, Eva and Maria and Them Queers, are both available on the Swedish Film Institute's online archive site, which is actually open, I think, globally, even though they're not subtitled on that site, but you can watch them. And The Woman in Your Life Is You is still not accessible in any archive at all. So it is important to know also about the three films that they do belong to this transnational film culture of liberation films and queer self-presentation in the Stonewall era, but in the national context of Sweden, like in the Swedish film culture, they're really unique and isolated cases of queer filmmaking. So they were the first, but also for a really long time, the only films by open queers in Sweden. So their production and distribution histories also reveal many interesting aspects of Swedish sexual policy making, etc., in this era, like the most striking part of their production histories is that the two lesbian films got their funding, their support from the state agency Socialstyrelsen, the National Board of Health and Welfare, through their kind of like allocated budgets for birth control and contraception. Contraceptives. So, because abortion was legal, like free abortion was legal in Sweden in 1975, so there was some money to support women's groups, and these lesbians very cleverly thought that, okay, there's some money. Okay, anyways, and the other paradox about this funding is that the National Board of Health and Welfare at this time still classified homosexuality as a mental disorder. But you will learn more about this history in the film, but I also want to mention again the volume that I very recently, is brand new, co-edited with Anna Koivunen and Katarina Kyrle, The Power of Vulnerability. It's free to download. It's open access through Manchester University Press. And so I have one chapter in the book where I detail this funding of the two lesbian films through the abortion prevention budgets, if anyone is interested in that. So what makes the three Swedish 70s films unique is really that they also represent this unusual window of opportunity in Swedish film history, where they were able to get this support and funding, but they did not like break a barrier for, you know, more queer filmmaking and self-presentation in Swedish cinema. And I mean, on the contrary, there were barely no other films of this kind for another 20 years. And still, today, Sweden really, don't really have like a queer film culture. I mean, despite self-promoting idea that Sweden is one of the most gay-friendly countries in the world, there's really like so little queer, representation in films and films made by queers in Sweden. This contradiction and also like the meaning of these three rare cases in the specific context of Swedish history and exceptionalism is one of the questions that I wanted to raise with my documentary. So it does focus on some of the paradoxes of the Swedish welfare state. But it is also a reflection on the very issue of queer self-presentation and the utopian force of queer cultural production and world-making, to speak with José Esteban Muñoz, whose thinking I'm very influenced by. So I wanted to draw attention to the activist act of reclaiming the image of oneself and how that contributes to queer counter publicity, to also use the terminology of Michael Warner. So one aim with the documentary has been to kind of like capture the magic and utopianism in queer audiovisual sub-presentation and the queer longing for utopia that these images evoke. Muñoz writes about queer cultural production as an insistence on the possibility of another world and as a casting of pictures of that world. He writes about the importance of mapping, quote, a world where one is allowed to cast pictures of utopia and to include such pictures in any map of the social, end of quote. But so, unfortunately, in the case of Sweden and Swedish pictures of queer longing for utopia and audiovisual publicity, because of archival neglect, these images have turned into a ruined map to a large extent. So, and that's using also another film scholar's words, Juliana Bruno, feminist film historian. So I'm thinking about about the queer audiovisual publicity in Sweden as this kind of like ruined map. In addition to the three films, the documentary builds on archival images from other sources that I came across in the research. So some both from official sources, such as the Swedish Television's archive, but also from the queer community. And so the process of working or kind of like coming across this archive has many interesting questions that perhaps I hope we can talk a little bit about in the discussion and that I want to reflect over now. So some of the images included in my documentary are from queer amateur films documenting various aspects of LGBTQ life at the time, such as lesbian summer camps, drag shows, and liberation marches. And none of this material is searchable or available in official archives, but they came to my attention and knowledge through activists from the older generation that I interviewed and visited in their homes. And I know this is very typical for many queer researchers looking for queer history and archives in people's homes and not knowing what or if anything will remain at all. But it was a very emotional process for me coming across stuff that I was hoping to find but didn't know if it existed. But it was also an emotional and sad process because a lot of this material was in a really bad shape. So for instance, I unexpectedly got access to material dating back to the mid-60s that documents drag shows at the queer club City Club in Stockholm. And it's really, really amazing material that was kept on a deteriorating VHS cassette, a cassette that was made in the mid-80s where they transferred all the Super 8 films and audio tapes to VHS because that was the best way to preserve it, they thought then. So when I saw this material 20 years later, I mean, the images were already kind of vanishing. And I think I'm going to play, this is like a mini clip from that was made for Instagram promotion, but I will play it to you. Now there's like, it's in Swedish with Swedish subtitles. Don't worry, tonight it's going to be with English subtitles, but I just want to show what it looks like.
På en bortglömd VHS-kassett ligger några av de tidigaste rörliga bilderna av queer subkultur i Sverige. Magiska glimtar in i kraften. Nödvändigheten är att skapa egna rum, liv och bilder i en värld av omöjlighet. På den legendariska 60-talsklubben City Club gjorde koreografen Rune Graffo dragföreställningar med namn som Missarnas afton och På havets botten. Den största succén var uppsättningen av Svansjön, även kallad Sjansjön, efter Sjana, ett annat slanguttryck för fjolla.
So, I mean, this is also not representative because it's like Instagram format, but as you can see, it's not, there's not much left of these images. And another example of really unique and valuable material that I got access to, also in the home of an older activist, were DVDs that had been made from also from a VHS cassette that once was had copied also Super 8 films onto it. So material that documents some of the very first liberation marches in Stockholm in the late 70s, and also images that were in really bad shape after all these copies and transformations between different formats. But the first time that I saw these images was the first time that that I saw the liberation parades documented from within, from people who were part of the parade, and that was incredibly moving. I'm not going to show this clip. There's some of it in there, but I think I'm going to start to try to wrap up. So these examples of this, I mean, really like hitherto neglected and overlooked material that I come across in my project, and I'm pretty sure there must be more, really proves how urgent it is that queer audiovisual heritage gets prioritized in Sweden. It's been really upsetting to realize the extent of neglect and lack of expertise regarding this kind of material in existing archives. So in the last few years, just in the last 2 years, irreplaceable material has been lost and even thrown out from both official but also community archives in Sweden because of this lack of understanding, and not understanding, realizing how valuable and unique and irreplaceable it is. So like if there's moving images kept on VHS cassettes, that has just not been prioritized. And another example is just a few years ago, the Swedish Film Institute decided to throw away all the behind the scenes material. That was quite a lot of material from one of the films from Eva and Maria that they had donated to them by one of the filmmakers because she had said, well, she was just felt happy that they wanted to accept the material at all, I mean the film in itself, and she said, if this is too much, you can throw this out. And they decided to do that, knowing that this was the first lesbian film, more or less, I mean, like, publicly funded lesbian film in Sweden. So, I mean, that's really, like, it's a scandal, really. So in a way, the film is also a call for the kind of like urgent preservation of queer audiovisual history in Sweden. And I'm going to end here, but I also want to mention that luckily there are now two new queer archives in Sweden, QRAB and SACMI. So I think luckily and hopefully these issues of queer audiovisual heritage will hopefully get better prioritized in the future. All right. Thank you.
Is Paul Dettweiler or Dettweiler from San Diego.
Okay, thank you. Is the volume okay? The volume okay? I'm very excited to be here and to share what I've done with you today. And as you see, I'm coming from an academic background, but in a different field. However, in my earlier days, I did work at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, where I spent a summer accessing, cataloging, and preserving a couple thousand jars of specimens in alcohol, which was the Institute's scientific research collection of marine animals. So I do feel a particular kinship with actual real archivists and museum collections people. I am an independent filmmaker also, and over the last 12 years I've gravitated towards projects that have dealt with queer memory. My earlier short documentaries relied heavily on personal memory and biography. And if you're interested, I can provide links later, and I have some DVDs available here too. In this presentation today, I position myself not as an academic to engage in discursive analysis, because that's not my field, but as a filmmaker, just to present the elements that were involved in creating two memory works that are disparate in tone, form, and process. But both of them relied heavily on materials gleaned from queer archives in Southern California. So as Hong Wei said, one of them, the short, is the 24 Hitchhikers, which is showing tonight in the first program, and the other is will be shown tomorrow at lunch. And both involve different strategies of how I approached and engaged with the material. So the films were made for different viewing arenas and audiences, and they also differ stylistically and in the creative approach. In 24 Hitchhikers, I was given visuals, and I had to create a story, while in the Gay Bar documentary, I gathered stories through interviews and then plumbed the archives and other repositories for supporting visuals. But in both, the intentionality behind them was the same, to be effective. Affective, because the film must be seen and heard and most importantly felt through an emotional connection if it is to inspire and empower and activate viewers. So I'd like to show you 24 Hitchhikers now in its entirety and view some excerpts from the longer documentary and discuss how works like these can be construed as forms as artistic activism. And then furthermore, I will offer suggestions how archives can extend their reach into the public sphere using filmmaking and digital media. Let's see, okay. Well, this particular project, the Hitchhiker Project, came about rather serendipitously while I was doing research at the One Archives in Los Angeles. And the curator, Michael Oliveros, who actually gave a talk yesterday here, showed me an interesting collection of photographs of hitchhikers who were picked up along the Pacific Coast Highway in Southern California during the 60s and 70s. When he showed me the storage box and I saw these raw faces of these young guys from 50 years ago, it was really like a wow moment, and I felt compelled to do something transformative with these with the material to share those images. And so, however, there's no background information on these images, so they conjured up questions, and I speculated on who were these men, what were their motivations for traveling. What were their stories? How did the photographer persuade so many of them to pose fully nude for him? What were his motives, ulterior or otherwise? And what were the players looking for in this exchange? There's no information on the hitchhikers. They weren't identified beyond their first names. And the photographer is long deceased, so that information will never be known. The photos guided my creative endeavor, which led to a visual exposition of thought. And the challenge was then to how to balance the license, taking license with the material and reimagining it into an artistic narrative without doing a disservice to what I felt might have been the photographer's intentions. So consequently, I wrote a narration to represent the voice of the photographer as I imagined it. I'm curious, have any of you hitchhiked before? Oh, well, Europeans, okay. I guess it must still be safe in Europe to do that. Well, not in America. You end up on the back of a milk carton. Okay. Well, so we'll have plenty to talk about in the discussion section then. In the American psyche, at least in the past, before it was scary and dangerous to hitchhike, the phenomenon of hitchhiking itself holds a special, certain place in the American consciousness. The aspects of counterculture, of transgressive behavior, and of course the romanticized bohemian perspective presented, articulated by the Beat Generation author Jack Kerouac in On the Road, was a very seminal piece of literature in American history. When queering hitchhiking, we cannot ignore the possibility of an implicit underlying transactional element. And as a teenager, I remember seeing bumper stickers, and I don't know if this happens in Germany, but in America you can plaster your car with stickers of all sorts of stuff. That doesn't sound like something that would be allowed in Germany, but the bumper sticker I remember seeing said, gas, grass, as in marijuana, or ass, this ride isn't free. So, of course, the scenario has also become a trope in gay pornography. Much like the pizza delivery guy. In fact, I included vintage porn footage in the work. So in the spirit of the conference theme of artistic interventions, I would like to offer this short film as an example of how archival materials encountered fortuitously with little to no associated documentation can nonetheless provide an opportunity for creative recontextualization. and reinterpretation to produce new narratives that honor queer lives and memories while respecting the source material. So I'd like to show you the piece now. It's just 5 minutes. And it was described by the San Francisco Gay and Lesbian Film Festival as, quote, a poetic short, equal parts meditative memory piece and bearded beefcake bonanza, unquote. Okay.
Why does this scenario consume my fantasies? How long have you been waiting, my errant friend? An offer to a stranger. Will you be a threat? Or will I see the same yearning reflected in your gaze? How did you captivate me? Was it with your nonchalant bravado? Or your quiet intensity? Or was I taken by what you represented? A carefree young buck on a California dream of reinvention. Nowhere to go but everywhere. Eager for bread and love. At my home, we initially shared a tenuous, unearned trust, the uncertainty of promise or peril, inciting an exquisite friction within me, so electric and addictive. I wanted to hear your stories, your ambitions. Were you searching for a place you could be yourself, where someone might find his other in you? Were you lonely on the road? What ardor burns behind your lambent eyes? I saw you, ingenuous and endearing, become open for another kind of adventure, open for exploration, the next step of your journey. The beer, a comforting trope to help rationalize your complicity in what followed. You knew to give back in guileless, awkward poses, or with an awareness of your own appeal and vulnerability. Did you realize the power in your self-assured looks, or how your tattoos thrilled me? Those badges of rough trade, both menacing and alluring. Was it just performance, or was a new desire emerging in you? Did it change you? Discovered, my roving swain, as you traveled across this golden state of dreams and through the circuitous landscape of your heart. Did you ever find what you were seeking? Did you find your other? Did you discover yourself?
Another archive-based project I produced was broadcast last year in June on KPBS, which is our San Diego public television station. And the film frames Gay Bar history within four major epochs: the post-war era to Stonewall, the 70s, the AIDS crisis in the 80s, and beyond to the present. And the scope of this topic was much more expansive as my research progressed. I found at least evidence of at least 135 gay bars operating in San Diego that have operated in San Diego since the 40s. And while one film can't presume to cover the multiple histories of a complex community, it did expose queer history to a wide audience. It was the first queer documentary that was ever broadcast by KPBS, a station that reaches 1.3 million households in the area. And the documentary, while regional in its focus, has a wider relevance because San Diego's queer history, viewed through the lens of its post-war gay bars and nightclubs, essentially parallels the historical development of the modern queer community in North America, and I imagine also in parts of Western Europe. I would encourage you to come watch it tomorrow, and I also have some DVDs for those of you who might want a copy for your institution. And I'd like to show you just the film's trailer, which provides an overview of the structure. And it starts with footage from San Diego's oldest gay bar, it's called the Brass Rail, and that's operated since 1957.
Let's see, I think that it's right up here. I think it's the place. Okay, let's go inside. What's your name?
Big Mike.
Big Mike. Great.
When I first started working here in 1989 at the Brass Rail, this was the drag bar.
My first gay bar experience was a place called The Apartment.
You could go to the Hut on University Avenue and down to Shadows, over to the Hole.
San Diego in the 70s.
Enough Donna Summers to just make a gag.
You know, we were outlaws.
We didn't know what was coming down the pike.
And then early 1980s, AIDS did equal death.
Am I going to die from this?
It made us angry because we're going to get the government to pay attention. There was nobody standing up for us. So we started raising money. And the only place to do so was in the bars.
The gay bars were always there for helping, taking care of people, taking care of friends.
The gay bars are a home for gay people.
You are not the only one.
This is where our world revolved.
We didn't have anybody else.
The bars not only built our civil rights movement and struggle, it also built our community of families.
So for the process of this documentary, I interviewed 35 members of the queer community in town, and many of these interviewees were longstanding activists recruited through their prior involvement in the oral history projects archived online as part of the California Audiovisual Preservation Project through archive.org. I asked people to recollect on their first gay bar experiences, the roles the bars played in during the AIDS crisis, and how the bars figured in the development of the community. And everybody was very eager to contribute, and it opened up a level of trust when they felt their stories would be told ethically and honestly. And as in interviewing, it's a little different from oral history, collecting oral histories. In documentary, you have to listen for threads and commonalities and how the parts fit together with what other people have been saying in previous interviews, all the while sort of directing a story out of the person. But commonalities emerged and their stories informed the types of photographs and other visual assets that we needed to collect from the archives to support their narratives. And we're very fortunate in San Diego that in the 70s, the early pioneer activists had the foresight to collect and preserve queer memorabilia and artifacts in the Lambda archives. Many photographs of the bar and bar images we used were digitized already by staff, and were thus searchable, but many were not, and took many hours of searching through uncataloged donations to find appropriate pictures. I got better pictures from bar owners, managers, and bartenders who gave me access to their personal photo albums. None of those had been donated to the archives yet, but several were in the course of this project. And I also used materials from these other sources, especially the GLBT Historical Society was very helpful too. And during the editing phase, after 100 hours of material, of footage, a lot of thought goes into deciding which narratives to include and how to distill them into compelling segments for broadcast, in particular to a general mass audience. We attempted to strike a balance between developing the different segments fully while representing both the diversity of viewpoints and the variety of San Diego gay bars that had existed over a 70-year period. And we had a really tight broadcast time limitation, so it was especially important in editing that we retain the interviewees' truth accurately and concisely while still preserving a fluid story. And like Ingrid was mentioning, we also had issues with visually documenting early history from the 60s and 70s. It was the lack of footage. There were several television news reports that on queer topics that were from the 70s and 80s that were housed in a local TV station in their archives, but the antiquated tape machine broke trying to get that material in the course of transferring it to digital, and there was no engineers left who knew how to repair that machine. And so, unfortunately, there were more titles, I couldn't access them, but I did extract a couple clips and use them in the documentary before the machine totally broke. And one clip, this will show you here, is an example of what the mass culture media in San Diego was their perspective on queers at the time.
I'm Papa Tony. I have been part of San Diego's leather community since 1977. Back in the 70s, being kinky was very much of a prisonable offense. The stereotypes were intense.
Many gays are peace-loving, gentle people who would hurt no one. But there's a violent subculture. They call it leather, or S&M.
So all we had was each other. The leather bars were our refuge. And there was a cycle of mentoring between the generations. It was very tribal.
Yeah, the queer audiences love that. They love that clip. It's so funny. This, well, straight people, they just sort of. Okay, well, without any early footage from San Diego bars, I went to the GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco, and I got some bar footage from the late 60s that was shot inside a bar in the Empress Reba collection. Is anyone from GLBT here? Watching that footage, and I'll show you a little clip of that too, it was again shot from within the community. I was struck by the atmosphere of joy and camaraderie that obviously was shown in how vital the bars must have been to people of that generation, who could have been arrested, lost their jobs, and even lost custody of their children as a consequence of being caught in a bar raid. But people still went to those bars, and the bars drew them in. And it speaks to our powerful need for connection that superseded the threats of our intolerant American society back then. And I'd like to show you a little clip of that because it is gold.
It's amazing that we created community under such hard conditions, that we were so reviled by the culture at large, that we couldn't know each other's real names. And we managed to make relationships
and mentor each other and continue as a culture. It was amazingly proud and courageous for homosexuals to show up in these spaces that were public, where they were going to get raided, where they were risking so much to put a public face to our community. But they did it, and I applaud them for it.
Okay. All right, since my timing is severely off, I'm going to jump to the end. And I practiced this talk twice, and I don't know what happened. Okay, all right. Talk to me afterwards about it. I'll fill you in with the rest of this. Okay. So archives, as we all know, archives are wonderful resources for queer researchers, artists, and storytellers to find new ways to discover and understand the diagonal lines and multiple arcs of our history. And because funding for community archives is usually a function of visibility, it would behoove archives to think about engaging video artists and filmmakers in creating works for publicity and outreach. Short films about the process of archival work, how curators prepare and assess an item, and assess some items that highlight current artistic projects or research being done, or even notifying the community about volunteer work, all have the potential to develop new audiences. And this echoes what I heard yesterday from a Swedish archivist who stated that we should also tell the stories of our collections, not just the stories in them. So the use of film and editing techniques such as montage, symbolism, juxtaposition, and motif can all work to inject new perspectives into archival materials to engage the public imagination and make connections across the historical divide. So hopefully with an increased visibility and concomitant level of support, archives will be able to sustain and expand their work in documenting and preserving the many facets of our diverse queer histories. Thank you.
Thank you for finishing on time, Paul. Our next speaker is Deepak from Bangalore, India, and he's going to talk about his film project. A lot of you may have missed Deepak's film, actually, which was shown before this panel, but I'm sure if you contact Deepak, he'll be happy to share his films with you.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone, and it was great, two very intense presentations and very poetic, and I got very absorbed in it. So forgive me if I lose track of what I'm going to say. Also because I took the idea of presenting a paper rather seriously, so I've written 7 pages of something, and I'm not in the frame of mind to go through all of it, but luckily I have some images. And so when the images show up, I will read a bit of it and maybe talk, because the pace is rather different for the session. I was a bit worried about making connections because I assumed both the presentations work with documentary, but it was a nice segue from, I mean, the idea of fiction, I think, features in both presentations, and in a way that, I mean, documentary is also kind of a storytelling of a sort, even if it is quote-unquote real. So from that kind of an idea, I segue into something like mythology, which in a way there are a lot of questions about in kind of, the sense of how you document and also memory, both are kind of belong to a very ephemeral space as opposed to historicity. So my paper will in some ways try and talk about a few of these things. If you missed the film is a rather simple coming out. Actually, I'd like to think of it more as a love story of some sort. And it's called Katha Vachak, which translates to storyteller, Katha being story, Vachak as a teller or the chronicler. And a young boy gets dragged to the storytelling event where he sees a storyteller who confronts him through the story in different ways, who enters his fantasy, and he has this. And then there is a parallel mythological narrative that runs through the story, which is the story that we will see here, in which we didn't really see in the film. We'll see some visuals of what that is. So it's a love between two male gods, which allows him to kind of experience his sexuality in some sense. So I start with the image of the storyteller, or the kathavachak, who actually opens with this line, "So many of us, we can't be ourselves." It has become increasingly difficult to be yourself, despite post-rationalist worldviews influenced by a number of global political social movements. In the queer world especially, despite a so-called understanding of struggles, which are political in nature, a narrative that usually begins from a modern telling and historic marking of Stonewall, global LGBTQ communities celebrate pride commemorating this contemporary history. Despite such left-aligned modern histories and struggles, political analysis reveals that LGBTQ plus communities, particularly those hailing from majoritarian populations, have been quite instrumental in helping elect right-wing governments across the world. Despite these governments blatantly or insidiously denying or violating LGBTQ plus rights. In India especially, one can't help but notice the strategy with which the currently ruling Conservative Party, which has just won its second term, unfortunately, chose to stay silent on the legality of the issue in the Supreme Court, despite making severe regressive religious and cultural disruptions in society. They didn't want to disrupt this huge, growing gay vote bank, and they somehow figured it's there, it's out there. Given this backdrop, one might assume that the sociocultural status of South Asian queer people is slowly shifting. And so there you will see a lot of transgender rights being recognized in South Asia. There's a lot of news that features. And it's quite interesting that you have a same-sex population which is more privileged that votes for you, but you always only land up talking about transgender rights from a class group that doesn't vote for you. So that's an interesting paradox of right-wing governments, especially in South Asia. And I believe it has something to do with them feeling that there's public empathy towards being a transgendered person, which is quite unique to, I think, some of the Western countries. There's more empathy towards transgendered individuals than same-sex lovers. And one of the reasons is my story, which is, so you might ask, what does all this have to do with my fiction film? What does someone like me excavating material with mythological archives, what am I doing with, why am I giving you this background? So as a young boy growing up in a culture steeped in storytelling, or katha as we call it, than a culture that valued historicity and facts, I have as an adult developed a skepticism and fascination for my culture. As an English educated South Asian, there is a kind of split in the culture that you notice in your own nation while growing up. Urban-rural divides are the most primary, but it also results in English speakers versus vernacular, and many other identity splits, something on the lines of what Nigerian novelist Chinua Achebe once spoke about in a colonial African context. So, in a way, what has happened is that there is no dialogue around there's no dialogue around colonialism, and we've jumped many steps. We have moved into modernism, postmodernism, globalism, post-globalism, digital era, and post-digital era. And India has been trying to keep up quite drastically, with drastic consequences, actually. And along with that, you have a mix of right-wing nationalism, which is, homegrown Hindu self-respect movement. And it's an interesting mix, because then you have a lot of othering that happens: Muslims, low caste, tribals, Maoists, and of course Pakistan. But the way you begin, or the way you work with this, is you belittle women primarily in this battle because they get attributed the cultural purity and the responsibility to retain roots because South Asian culture is measured by how much a woman embraces her roots. Men can modernize, but women cannot. In this context, the aspect of courtship and sexuality threaten right-wing beyond measure. The boogeyman is the liberal, with his or her liberalism, which to the right is an unfathomable extreme characterized by sex, drugs, immorality, aka borrowed heavily from Western culture. So why am I trying to talk about this? Because I feel there is a connection between the expression of masculinities. There is something about the threat to South Asian masculinities that has come through this process of colonialism, and it manifests as violence against women and transgenders. And there is a threat. There is a threat to the idea of masculinities, I assume, that is at play. Post-colonial white male supremacism resulting from colonialism has led to a fragmentation of multiple masculinities of men of color. It has led to a lack of global negotiation, once important in the old worlds, those of pride, dignity, and recognition. What can one do in today's context, in today's frame of the modern, to stand up and speak? And it's ironic that I'm going back to myths. So myths reveal deeper psychological cultures of masculinity from a time we can't fully access, in a way that these stories have been shaped and edited, especially in oral traditions, according to the permissibility of almost alien social norms we call tradition. In the context of my film, Kathavachak or Storyteller, I explore this different sort of masculinity, those of the gods. The story is of two male gods, Shiva and Vishnu, who have an erotic encounter after a near-fatal adventure for one of them. So Shiva is an androgynous god known for his habits, both nationally and now internationally, because he's the original hippie, smoking up, intoxicated, but also mostly celibate and renunciate, but he can also be increasingly sexual. Vishnu, the other aspect of Hindu divinity, reveals another manifestation of masculinity, which is slippery, shrewd, manipulative. But the interesting thing is both these gods are pliant and transformable. Shiva, as you can see here, this is an image by the artist Ravi Varma, and you can see that he very seamlessly combines a masculine right body and a feminine left body, and the body garments are feminine. This is a more, quote-unquote, contemporary rendition, and you have the folk forms that very clearly have like a different male side, which is the blue side, and the female side, which is the yellow part. So a lot of traditional depictions of Shiva are in this form, which is Ardhanarishwar, half man, half woman, or neither man or woman. So in philosophy, they look at it as both, a combination of two or beyond as well. Vishnu, on the other hand, takes many forms. He's born as a human to liberate man through time. He's a soothsayer, philosopher, warrior. But he also has a special feminine form called Mohini, which the stories describe as the most enchanting female force in the universe. So here is a traditional kind of calendar art way of looking at Shiva, Shiva's on the right and Vishnu's on the other side. And this love story kind of talks about the coming together of these forces after how Shiva kind of Vishnu rescues Shiva. So the story is told over and over again of this demon who chases Shiva after he receives a boon. The boon is that he can place his hands on anybody's head and they turn into ashes. And he wants to test it out, so he chases this god, and Vishnu intervenes, and in the form of Mohini. So the usual telling in households or in heteronormative societies is that Vishnu completely transformed into a woman, And a lot of scholars have asked, what is this complete transformation of a male entity, even if it's a god, and have challenged this kind of heteronormative rendition. Ruth Vanita and Salim Kidwa are among the scholars who painstakingly and sensitively traced and documented Hindu and Islamic mythical and historic narratives in the South Asian region. Narratives of South Asian mythology present unusual gender metamorphoses and allow for romantic emergences between same-sex and transgender couples. Many of these stories have plural variations in different oral cultures within the country. They also get told in mainstream religious and cultural contexts and get accepted despite a dominant homophobic public culture. So this again is a storybook narrative, and this is how the thing plays out. Vishnu as a woman dances with the demon and gets him to place his hand on his head, and he dies. And then the romance ensues, and you have a very different form again that usually you see, where the coming together of two male energies is again displayed this way, of half Shiva on one side and half Vishnu on the other side, as opposed to what we saw earlier. However, here you have a binary that's shown, but here you don't have Vishnu in the form of Mohini, you always have Vishnu being shown as a male form. So that's quite interesting, and it has helped a lot of scholars to write about this and really reinterpret the myth. So the composite idea of story, memory, and history is what I look at in terms of working with the idea of katha or story, which also means chronicling, recounting, and of course storytelling. Actually, we'll come back to this image. Indian society is uniquely rational and yet has embraced a rapid capitalist hypermodernity that doesn't seem to relent. Without exploring our collective psyches of the traumas of colonialism, we've rapidly moved into various realms of being modern and a developing nation. Yet the influence of religious traditions and narratives that have gotten much distorted through the passage of time and tongues is strong. For the period that these myths and narratives are only symbols of some ancient past, not to be worried about too much, stories exist and were told or read as is without much interpretation. With the stepping in of a conservative purity, which is being touted as a potential Indian version of 20th century German nationalism gone wrong, the need to reframe narratives without interpretation and to curb, force, twist, and weed out literature, art, and research, or archiving attempts to claim a more diverse, inclusive, and plural cultural past. This has been leading to censoring visualization seen and things seen only through a heteronormative lens. So what am I proposing? I think the film in some ways tries to re-eroticize queer love and introduces the mythology as a kind of backbone through which it eroticizes it. And I just like to talk about a couple of those elements that I use in the film. One of starting with the music, because the music really comes from a tradition of Devadasis dancers who were in some ways, I mean, there are three colonial moments. I'm not going to go through all of those three in my fiction work, but the Devadasis were women who, I'll just maybe read a bit. Strategic colonial stripping of the Devadasi or the dance girl from her social position as a cultured artist and citizen to a common prostitute was a blow dealt by the British administration to Indian imagination of culture, womanhood, and sexuality. There's a lot of work that's emerged from scholars like Anjali Arondekar who speak of a tradition of the kotha, the space that was a public space, but public culture today has crudely translated this to a brothel. While sex work was a part of the kotha, the idea of multiple partnership for women or men in those days at the kotha swung between being held, was mostly held, thought of as being a sacred act. Much of the classical forms of dance, especially music and performing arts, that India patronizes, has huge contributions from kotha culture, as these have been spaces of art production. So in my film, I feel I borrow from this musical tradition, because the women also, the music has a lot of unrequited yearning, melancholy, and for me, this has been how I perceive queer love. There is a lot of South, you know, there is a lot of unrequited love, especially in the South Asian context, men seeing men desiring men, living out a fantasy, and never really meeting. So that's what happens also in the story. And the music kind of pays a tribute to women of this community who created a lot of these forms for us. So I think maybe I'll just end there. The other two, the myth already I've spoken about, and if you've seen the film, or maybe when you see it, you'll get a sense of it. I lost my train of thought, so I'll stop here. I saw 5 minutes.
For saving us some time. Can I invite all speakers to be on stage to pick up questions? Okay, so thank you very much for keeping the time, and it's a really wonderful panel. I will save my question to the end if we have time, but let's pick up some questions from the floor. So please raise your hand if you have any questions. And we have a volunteer holding the mic, so make sure that you talk to the mic. Okay, so while we're...
I have a question for Ingrid. Since we both had issues with video, obtaining video footage, did you have any encounter any? What types of material is available in the mainstream Swedish archives, if any? Or
thank you very much. I mean, what a disaster to have that tape stolen or eaten by that machine, but very fascinating clip, and that really made me think a lot about the differences between the kind of official public television records of LGBTQ history and what material that was shot from within the parades or within bars looked like. So I, in my documentary, I also work with the Swedish television material, and that whole process of finding that material took a long time because it's not cataloged in a way that makes sense at all. You can try all the search words that you can think of, but it was so much like snowballing, reading a news clipping that referred to some TV show, or kind of like a TV show that would refer back to something that was broadcast 10 years earlier. So that was a whole process in itself. But of course, what has also, tying in with my argument is what has been upsetting is that material is kept in a much better shape than a lot of the archive that I came across in people's homes. So it's this whole question about with what kinds of images and pictures will we be able to remember queer history in Sweden, and it makes such a big difference who shot it, where, what's the perspective. And also because my film is also dealing with this question in a way of Swedish exceptionalism and this kind of idea that we have this progressive history, I've also felt from some of the maybe more straight and cis people that have been involved in the project, like commissioners or others who've seen that material, they always liked the Swedish television material, for instance, the electrical shock therapy, conversion therapy that you saw in the trailer, better than the crappy, amateur footage, because they felt the quality is really problematic. How is this going to work? And But of course, this kind of like oppression of like conversion therapy is like, yeah, that's so great. That's really interesting material. I was really provoked in a lot of these meetings, like having to explain, well, you know, the most important material in my project are these archive images that are now, you know, vanishing, and that really, like, for the first time will you know, bring these, in a moving image, you know, history back to a queer, you know, audience in Sweden. Yeah, but I can say so much about this, but I will, I feel like, but so, I mean, it would be interesting to hear your reflections on that same questions, like the difference between using, you know, different kinds of archives.
It was just very fortunate that San Francisco had that footage, because there was no footage in San Diego that the archives had. And I mean, there might be footage that people shot, but it didn't make it to in San Diego, that didn't make it to the archives, and you know, we don't know. There was a documentary an American documentary, I think it was called Out of the Closet, but it was about people's home movies, queers, the home movies. Do you remember that one? It spoke to that very issue. How people found this gold in their closets, and so it was like a call to, you know, for people to, you know, donate the materials, and because there was home movies of lesbians in the 30s in New England, and that stuff is, you know, so there was a documentary. I can't remember the title, but I could look it up real quick.
Can I ask a follow-up question? So which is that in both of your films, you used a lot of private images and home videos, etc. And, how do you deal with the ethical issues of first using those images, I mean, probably with or without people's consent? Second, which is that how you interpret the videos, whether actually you are interpreting it with a poetic lesson, sometimes against the subject's will, if you like.
Every documentary has a point of view, and working with the material, primarily to be ethical, you have to use the material conscientiously. You know, I can't juxtapose something and make an interviewee's statement in contraposition to what the person's saying, or what the person believes. So the other issue about consent is that all the materials I used were donated to the archives and they were signed away. So, I mean, legally, there's no issue with that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is such a really crucial and important question, and like exactly what you say, like it's, and oftentimes not all of the people who are in these images will be alive or be able to identify and find. So I've thought a lot about this, and in my project, to the extent that it's been possible to get in touch or identify people, I've done that. But I've also made the decision to use it, and you know, I know I don't have the consent of everyone who are in the images. And there have been screenings where people have seen themselves and luckily been happy about it, but I also know that the opposite could happen, and then that will perhaps, you know, need to be a new version of it or a thorough discussion about it. But I mean, so it's a risk, and I am not super, I'm not like content about that, but I did at one point make the decision that I'm actually going to use these images from the City Club from the 1960s. There's one guy who's alive from that gang who ran the club and who made this VHS in the 80s, and so I have his consent, but he said, I mean, almost everyone is dead, so I...
Well, in my film, real quick, I showed at film festivals, and I've always hoping that some guy in the audience will be like, hey, wait, that's me, you know. that guy would be in his mid-60s or pushing 70, but that would be, I was kind of hoping, like in San Francisco, you know, in California, the film festivals, that someone would get up and say, yeah, that was me. But it hasn't happened yet, so.
Hi, thank you very much for these wonderful presentations and for the work of making these films. What a lot of work that is. As a non-filmmaker, I can't even imagine. My question, I think, begins, Deepak, with you, and something that you said kind of at the beginning of your presentation, which was around the kind of context of your film and the... I guess the kind of colonial conditions of the kind of larger geopolitical colonial histories of the stories that you're telling, or the story that you're telling. And I guess I'm curious to start off with that, and just to kind of ask you if you could say more about that and how that maybe frames, structure, shapes something, your project and your larger project, I imagine. And then for Ingrid and Paul as well, just thinking about the national context and larger geopolitical issues, either within the nation or more globally, in terms of these, in many ways, very personal stories that you're telling. And I guess I'm just kind of thinking about the relation between the very intimate personal stories and the larger geopolitical stories in the nations that you're kind of located in, but also more broadly in terms of how these films circulate in a transnational context or a translocal context.
If I understood you right, so the only way I can answer it is I kind of frame it as, to put it very crudely, if one were working with human rights issues or talking, I mean, it's kind of fashionable with queer left movements to talk of issues. And once you delve into the area of mythology and religion, immediately the hands off, you know, it's like, okay, I really can't touch you. So it's a weird kind of quandary to be in, because my content in a way is dubbed right wing because of the kind of telling that I'm doing by queer activists or by, you know, people from the NGO sector or whatever. And the right doesn't like it either. They're like, you can't be so liberal and you can't interpret it, because it has to be a heteronormative way. So that is something I was alluding to, and also the complexities of how the queer community itself is split in terms of its politics, despite the larger kind of view that activists have, that, you know, once you feel this way, you have a lot of intersectionality, you would feel for Muslims or you would feel for others, but you don't. I mean, when it comes to this, you're very clear about it. So in a way, it's in a very messy area, and I'm also trying to figure it out, and that's what I was trying to locate it in. What I really wanted to end on was on this idea of re-eroticizing society, because when I speak of colonialism, it is also that, you know, that stripping of eroticism that existed in multiple areas, which the fiction genre allowed me to draw in without again going too much into the archive, which actually the presentation does in terms of presenting images, but the film doesn't. So yeah, that's briefly what it was.
Yeah, maybe I need a clarification about the question.
Well, I guess I'm just thinking about, the way that you frame your film in terms of these lesbians making use of funding that's available in the context of reproductive rights and freedom is really interesting, because that's a national policy. Law, a kind of, you know, impact of potentially the impact of feminism in Swedish culture and legal history, and so you're already talking about that. But I'm also just thinking about, what does it mean, like, your film is circulating in Europe and then will circulate elsewhere. What does it mean for a film about queers in Sweden in the 70s to circulate around the world? And what is the story that it's telling about Sweden or something else? Or is it really just about the people who are in those films and not necessarily something broader. And I'm not saying that it should be about something broader. I'm just really curious about what that kind of political relationship is. Maybe it's not an answerable question. Maybe I just really wanted to ask Deepak to say more about colonialism, and I tried to make it broader.
I think it's a great question. I mean, I think maybe also what I was trying to say in the presentation is that I mean, I see these two kind of like I've definitely had like these two aims with the film, which is very much like dealing with and questioning like the Swedish history, and really also trying to contextualize the history, like production and reception histories of these films in the particular context of like Swedish state feminism in the 70s. And then on the other hand, I've like, and perhaps that's more part of the like aesthetics of my documentary, is it's trying to evoke like this sense of utopianism and what I said about Munoz's notions of like queer utopian longing and casting pictures of utopia. So I think in the form of the film, that has been part of what I really wanted to get at, and that is something that I also, because I've also write about this material, so in academic texts. So of course, I don't want to make a film that is just a film version of my academic text at all. I mean, so I think what the film has the potential to do is really to, I mean, convey a lot of the emotions that I have had coming across this material. I mean, so the force they have, and the meanings they carry, maybe beyond what I would be able to put down in text. Yeah. And that is about the utopian aspect of it. Yeah.
Great. Thanks. Do you want to respond?
Well, I would just say in a general sense, I mean, individual stories resonate with individuals. And, Hitchhiker 1, I have a Spanish version, and it's played in Latin America, and they seem to love it in Latin America. It's played in like 12 different, six different countries down there. And even the San Diego story is really the general story. San Francisco story, and it's Amarillo, Texas story, and St. Louis, and maybe even Toronto. I mean, the formation of like modern urban gay culture, and the centrality of the bars and their foundational role in the community development. I mean, that's kind of generic and all encompassing for a lot of different places. So, and I think people see any type of representation. People can see themselves in. So that's that. Okay. So.
Yeah, I'll have to wrap up here because of the time. So, can I encourage you actually to talk to the presenters? I mean, after the session, and better still, come to tonight's film screening night and come to tomorrow's films if you have any more questions. So, thanks very much for coming, and thank our presenters.
Thank you.